Hi, everyone. We've set up this Being an Engineer podcast as an industry knowledge repository, if you will. We hope it'll be a tool where engineers can learn about and connect with other companies, technologies, people, resources, and opportunities. So make some connections and enjoy the show.
The people that I've seen that have been successful, if they want something, they just do it and they figure it out.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Being an Engineer podcast with your co-host, Rafael Destai. Today, we have a very special guest, someone that I've been following for years now, and his name is Scott Tarsi. He is an engineer by trade and now an entrepreneur and business owner who runs CADDesignHelp.com. All the links will be in the show notes, helping inventors and companies bring their ideas to real parts. Host of the Engineer Entrepreneur podcast, a podcast specifically about the engineering and technical side of entrepreneurship. His strategy is to interview engineers, designers, inventors who have created businesses around their inventions and products. You can contact him at info@caddesignhelp.com. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So happy to talk to you. And I've been following your podcast, Engineering Entrepreneurship Podcast. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit more about your podcast and what they could expect to find if they head over there?
Yeah, I've done 110 episodes or so far. I've interviewed people across all types of industries and areas. For example, inventors, designers, engineers, people at the patent office, patent agents, patent attorneys, software engineers, just entrepreneurs of all different types, a guy from Italy that has a sheet metal factory and wrote two books on like processing sheet metal. So it's expanded a large array of topics.
So I was reading on your website why you started the podcast. So I already know. Why don't you tell the audience why you started this podcast?
Yeah, I started that in 2016 because I couldn't find a show that for anybody that was doing sort of what I was doing. And so I said, okay, well, I'll just go ahead and start it. And I think it was a good decision.
Absolutely. Okay. What's something that you see a common trend from the entrepreneurs and business owners that you interviewed, something that they're doing right that you may want to share with our audience?
I think that at least if this is the way you want to go, that they're very self-starters, right? Like, so the people that I've seen that have been successful, if they want something, they just do it and they figure it out. And it's very easy to overanalyze and spend too much time. You know, like, for example, some people are like, I want to start a business. I have to get LLC and you have to do all. Yeah, I mean, you need to do those things, but you don't have to do them right away. Like, it's more important to start getting customers and even like a business plan. You don't really need to sit down and write it out. You just need to have it in your head of like, okay, what is the service or product I'm going to sell? And, you know, and how am I going to generate money? And like, it's more important, I think, to get started doing that and figure out other stuff as you go. Cause a lot of people just spend way too much time in the planning phases and never really get going. And I was guilty of that when I first started too. I didn't really take enough action to really get the business running, you know, for a couple of years, honestly.
And if I can, I want to ask you, what are some podcasts that you subscribe to that are not your own, but that you enjoy yourself?
Yeah, the Tropical MBA is a big one. That's all about location independent entrepreneurship, which I pretty much am. I mean, I can pretty much run my business from anywhere.
What is it called again? Nice and Slow. What is it?
The Tropical MBA podcast.
Okay, Tropical MBA. I'm looking that up right now, just like probably our audience is. All links in the description. Interesting. Okay, Tropical MBA. What else?
Tim Ferriss Show. Definitely a big fan of that. I mean, reading the 4-Hour Workweek was a big part of the beginning for me.
Okay.
Let me think. Probably those two for entrepreneurship.
What about the 4-Hour Workweek guy you started? What are five things you remember from that book that stood out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I get that answer all the time because I really wanted to create a lifestyle business where I was in control and could work when and where I wanted. And so Tim Ferriss, back in like 2007, wrote the book. But before that, I guess he kind of just figured it out. He created like some type of supplement company, and he got to the point where he outsourced and automated so much of it that he didn't work 4 hours a week, but like that was the catchy title. But he would work a lot, and then he would take like 3 months off. But he created the business with processes such that he could pretty much do what he wanted. And I really liked everything I read in there. And I've done a lot in my business too. I mean, I can really take a lot of time off if I want to. And this thing will still run with, you know, I would say minimal effort. I can't totally take off time, but I've got it to where, I mean, I have a lot of other people and systems handling what I need to get done. So I took, that was my main takeaway from that book was, you know, with the power of the internet and putting the right people in place, you don't have to go and do it all yourself.
Nice. I'm very happy for you. Not a lot of entrepreneurs reach that stage. They're just solopreneurs. They end up doing everything themselves and they're busy all the time. And they unfortunately not nothing on anyone, but they can't be there for the families because they're always doing every small little task. So why don't you tell us what was one thing that you did in your business that really helped clear up your schedule and automate a lot of processes?
Yeah, I mean, I hired contractors was the biggest thing because this is the thing a lot of people don't do is they want to be in control so much. And if that's the way you want to be, that's fine. But you have to accept the reality of you're going to work 60, 80 hours a week if you have enough jobs coming in because if you're a service business anyways, because how are you going to get them done? And so I found out early on because I was doing all the work myself that I was spending like a lot of time on it. Not that I hated it because I like doing design, but I didn't really want to work myself into another job. I had a job before that. My point is I wanted to free up a lot of my time to do other things. But even more than that I was really limited in how much I could make because if I'm doing all the jobs, there's really only so much I can take on. By bringing in contractors to get a lot of this work done, I could really scale as high as much, you know. I've never, put it this way, I've never been able to get so many jobs coming in that I couldn't get them finished. You know what I mean? Like I could basically at this point triple, if I could get that many jobs coming in, I could do that. I could do triple the amount or more. And I would hire more people if I needed to. I mean, it would get to a point where it would get a little ridiculous trying to manage, you know, like right now I manage 3 people, but if I had to manage like 7, 8, I might get a lot of control, but I've never had that problem. But you know, for what I want to do and income I want to make, 3 people work on my team is fine. I keep them fairly busy and you know, it's good for me there.
Okay. Perfect. And when did you take the leap that you hired your first? Do you hire employers? Do you have freelancers? How do you work?
Yeah, they're pretty much just freelancers. But I mean, it's not hard to get them. They're happy to do the work because they're good, and I can use them continuously. But they get work from other people too, or they have, or some of them have a full time job and do this on the side. I found them on probably like Upwork or one of those sites. The one guy found me directly. And I kind of like that because that showed that he was more ambitious, I would say, than like me reaching out to somebody. And, you know, some people didn't work out and they didn't do a good job. I mean, it definitely took some trial and error to find people that were reliable that I could work with. I mean, and also, you know, I like to turn around stuff fast to try to keep work, you know, to keep customers happy and you know, get recurring work. So some of the people I've tried in the past were too slow. They couldn't get it done fast enough. And so, you know, I moved on from them.
Tell me about the moment when you decided, okay, it's time to hire my first freelancer. I want to delegate this. What's a book that helped you in that process or a resource? Because that's a completely different skill set from what you learned in engineering school. Right?
I didn't read anything about that. I just kind of used common sense. I mean, I was an employee for a long time. So I know what I hated. And what I hated was somebody micromanaging the crap out of me. So when I brought people on, I said, listen, like, I don't care when you do this. I don't really care how you do it, minus a few certain things. And I wrote that in a document. I wrote, here's what I want. Like, for example, I don't want any unconstrained lines. I work in SolidWorks for the most part. And I said, because I will have to go in and edit this. So at some point, there's going to be some revisions. And I don't want to have to go to you if it's going to take 5 minutes for me to just go in there and do it. So I want you to follow these steps. Like, okay, you know, use millimeters or inches, depending on the project. Use all the lines need to be constrained. Like I had a certain, and I can't remember all of them, but there's like a document that I wrote. And I said, outside of this, I don't care how you do it. Like, I'm not going to micromanage you, you know, but there's certain things I ask and, you know, that's it. Like, and then you can just do what you want. And that's kind of, that's how I've always wanted to be treated. I wasn't always treated that way when I was an employee. A lot of times I was micromanaged, being told every little thing drove me nuts. And so I just kind of used the approach of like, how would I want on the other side of the table here? If I was, you know, the employee or the contractor and the guy was giving me work, like, how would I want it handled? And then it seemed to work pretty well. So, you know, I don't think it's too hard to manage people. I mean, you just got to give them, you know, here's the expectations, you know, and I need it done by then. And as long as they're basically doing that, it works well for everybody involved.
I think that speaks volumes. I can relate 100%. The way that I work is the same way. I just ask my direct manager, just tell me what you need and what you need to buy, and I'll have it done by you. And yeah, I don't really like the micromanagement aspect either. Like people peeking over your shoulder, looking at what you're doing on the computer. I mean, I'm gonna get it done by when you need it, and it's gonna be very well done. That's all we need to know. And I work well that way. So, but it also takes a certain personality type, because unfortunately, with some individuals, it's almost like you gotta touch base with them frequently, or otherwise they'll procrastinate all the way and they'll won't be able to meet the deadline. Do you agree on that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes I try to, what I ask is that you give me an update every 24 hours, or at least when you stop working and say, where are you at? But like I said, I've got three guys that pretty much do most of the work, and, you know, they know what to do. I don't really have to bug them too much about it. I mean, sometimes they go on vacation or something. You know, I have a couple backup people that I'll use, but, you know, that's exactly right. You know, as long as we're on the same page, there's really not a lot of issues there.
And I'm just curious, and if this too much information, because I'm the kind of person that I keep on digging in more details and details. Is your team all in the United States?
No, just one person here. I mean, because of margins, obviously, it'd be too expensive to have, you know, everybody here. It wouldn't be too expensive, but I mean, at the end of the day, I'm trying to, you know, have the best profit margin I can. So, you know, I have a guy in Brazil, India, a woman from Bulgaria, and one guy local. A local guy is important too, because a lot of times I got to physically measure stuff and reverse engineer it, and it's not practical for me to send something across the world. So it kind of depends on the nature of the project.
Absolutely. Makes sense. All right. Let's see. Do you have a family?
I'm married, so just a wife, no kids.
Congratulations. Okay. And yeah, I'm going to get married in a month. So
nice. I'd like to ask. Congratulations to you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, she actually, her name is Navia, and she actually just moved in 2 days ago here in Phoenix, Arizona. So we're very excited. And I like to ask other engineers, what's their routine like? And I mean, there's a lot of married engineers out there that they may want to hear that. What's your routine kind of like?
Well, I'm big into like fitness and going to the gym and playing sports. So, you know, I might play golf sometimes or go on my mountain bike. I like to work 3 to 4 hours a day typically. So outside of that, I'll read or just watch TV, or like I said, like a big fitness guy. So I do spend a lot of time doing that. Another side of the business too, that I spend some time on that we hadn't really talked about, was like my invention side. So when I started the business, and even now, like the revenue of the customer of doing design work for a fee, it goes up and down. And when I first started, I didn't even have any machine, any 3D printers. And then I bought one because people would always be like, oh, you did the invention, you did the design, but I want a prototype. And I would outsource that. And I was like, man, I could make a lot more if I just bring these in-house. And these machines aren't that expensive. I mean, I have 3D printers ranging from $400 up to like $6,000. So I've invested some money, but, you know, I can do all this stuff from home. And so when I had these printers, I realized that if they're not operating, like there's an opportunity cost here. Like I could be making something that someone would buy. So I've come up with all these like random things that I sell online, And that's been a nice boost, and it evens out the revenue to where like people might be buying this stuff on my Etsy store and stuff like that, even if I don't have any current like design jobs. So, you know, a little of my time's going into that too. Honestly, like the maintenance of these machines is probably like was like the hardest learning curve. Just even like operating it, like the very first 3D printer, it took me like 6 months just to get the thing to work once. But now I've done it so many times, they're all similar, you know, I got different brands that I can figure it out pretty quickly now. But man, at the beginning, it was really a headache. I had to sell a couple. I just couldn't repair them. Sold it for scrap, basically. But that's, you know, that's an important part of the business now, for sure.
What's so hard about getting a 3D printer to work, just so the people that want to 3D print at home, they know what's coming?
Yeah, I mean, you know, most people, I'm going to assume they're going to run an FDM printer like me. I do have one SLA machine, which is actually much easier to run. But when it breaks, it's much harder to fix because it's complicated. But let's just speak FDM for a minute, fused deposition modeling, which is your traditional take the wire, plastic, pull it through the nozzle, heat it up, put it down. Well, when you first start, you don't realize how precise, and I'm talking with like well less than a millimeter accuracy, you have to be from this distance from the nozzle to the bed. Like if it's not dead on, it will either not stick to it, which will cause all kinds of problems later, or it will be too close and it just like will jam up, and that'll cause a whole bunch of problems too. Basically, we have to disassemble the thing and like clear it all out. I mean, it takes, and it's just hours of extra work if you screw this up at the beginning. And it was so hard to get it right. Outside of that, you know, all kinds of stupid stuff happens. Like the machine just turns off in the middle of it for no reason. The power goes out. Something will break randomly. Like, I mean, a screw falls out. I've seen everything, like everything you can imagine. Software problems. Like I proofed the other day, like I'm scrolling down to print the next file and it just restarts. And it's like, I had to find out through just a Facebook group that, oh, I had to update the firmware because I don't know what happened to the firmware, but it went bad somehow. Like just on and on and on. It just, it's endless. But I mean, I would say it's worth it because of how much additional, I guess, money I could make running them, and, you know, the benefit of being able to like make prototypes versus having to always outsource everything.
Okay. So let's go bit by bit. So to my understanding, not only have, and thank you for being so open with us, that the income from the jobs they do for engineering, but also to supplement that income, because it's hard to gauge how much people want this, like a feast or famine, I guess sometimes, right? Like a lot of jobs coming in. Okay, so we agree on that. So then the stability comes from you're making money from the 3D prints because the people that you did the designs for in CAD, they now want to have the tangible part in their hands, the prototype. So boom, you get to sell them that. But also you're saying that you get to sell your own products that you 3D print on Etsy. Is that right?
That's right. And that's honestly the easiest income pretty much because the design is done, right? It's literally just when somebody orders it, I print it. Or sometimes, because of it's of demand, I know that I will sell it. So I just pre-print, you know, a certain quantity of different products. But a lot of times I just make it after they send it because it's not, if it's not too big of a print, I don't need, they need to pre-print, like pre-produce it, which is another nice thing about printing versus molding is like, I don't have to go buy 10,000 at once due to minimum order quantities, right? I just make it when it's ordered. So yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. That's the other revenue stream. And I'm looking at other ways to have other revenue streams as well. Cause like that's another big part. If you study entrepreneurship, like Tim Ferriss's book, 4-Hour Work Week, is you definitely want to have multiple sources of revenue. You don't want to rely on entirely one thing. Cause who knows what's going to happen, right? You'd rather have backups in place in case something drops, you've got other options.
Absolutely understood. Let's see. 3D printers. Well, I really want to have the link to your Etsy store, if that's okay. I want to check out some of your products. All right, if you want to send it to me via chat while we're on the call, and I'm going to also think about, let's see, you're in the company, okay, 4 hours a week, now 4 hours a day. Is your goal to do maybe 1 hour a day if you keep scaling, or you want to stay at 3 or 4 hours a day of work?
Well, if I scale the business, I'd probably have to work more hours, not less. So yeah, no, I really only want to, let's see here. I found my link here for you. I really only want to scale if it's going to have like minimal impact on my time. My time is my most valuable resource. I want to be free to do what I want to do. I don't want to have to be too bogged down. So I'm very careful. Like, I don't take on all opportunities because I don't want to be too bogged down. So if I can take on something that's going to, let's say, double the income and only be an extra few hours a week, then that's something I would do. But I wouldn't take on an opportunity that would be, let's say, you know, extra 20% for an extra 30 hours a week. That would not be worth it. You know, like, there's a trade-off there.
Okay, understood. How did you find, I got your link, we'll talk about that next. How did you find your sweet spot? Did you accept a job and then you realize this is taking too much of my time, maybe I want to scale back? Is that what happened?
I do have a story of this one guy who wanted to, it was some big kind of mining equipment. He wanted to sit with me at the computer for like 40 hours a week. And I said, absolutely not, because I don't want to physically have to be doing this. I don't want to work. I basically don't want to work myself into another job. Like, that would just be like going back to being a salary employee at that point. Like, and on top of that, if I'm spending that much time with this guy, there's no way I can be taking other jobs. So the minute he decides to stop work doing this, I'm left high and dry with nothing in the pipeline, income wise. And I have to go and, you know what I mean? It's going to be weeks before I'll find another job, like another, contract. So I said I would do it most 10 hours a week, and the rate's going to be higher since I have to sit there directly with you. And he didn't want that. So I turned down.
So the part that I don't understand is, what do you mean by sit next to the guy?
Like, literally we would go to his office or coffee shop or wherever he wants to go. And he would sit next to me at the computer and tell me what he wants done. Basically,
why can't he just send it to you via email?
I guess the complication of it, or I don't know, he probably just wanted to micromanage me, I guess. But I just said I wasn't willing to do that for the reason I listed either way. I do think it was crazy. I mean, I've worked for people all over the world. I've worked for people from Germany, all kinds of stuff. I mean, I will admit, if you're not in person and it's complicated, it's a little harder, but it's not impossible to get it done. You know, it's really not. Sometimes I do wonder why people don't give me all the information. Like, perfect example. I'm doing this job for Daimler Trucks right now, where they drill holes into the hood to mount some other equipment, right? And so they need – the guy was not very clear in the communication. I thought he wanted me to take the CAD file of the hood of the truck and put the holes in. And they had the coordinates. They had a very good drawing with all the coordinates, so that's what I did. Well, what they wanted was actually like a hand tool that – imagine like a handle with the surface of the truck and in a small area that you'd place over it. And then you simply, and then that this temp, they call it a template. This tool essentially has four holes where you're going to drill through. You're going to hold that in place and use that to run the drill through that, and then through the hood, right? Like, this is like pre-assembly to have those pre-hole drills. Well, he had pictures of a similar tool and never sent me that. So I thought all he meant was update the CAD file with that, put these holes in it, when he really meant create this tool. But never, like, why wouldn't you just send me the pictures of the tool that's very similar to what I want me to make? Like, that would be much more clear. Like, if I was going to hire someone to do that for me, I would 100% do that. Like, people just, it drives me nuts when people, like, don't understand that I can't read their brain. And they send me so little information, even when I desperately try to drag it out of them. And then I eventually have to just start the job because they won't give me any more information. And then it ends up being a miscommunication because I just don't know why you wouldn't think to tell me that. Like,
when you communicate, do you do it only written, or do you guys do Zoom calls?
No, I do calls. I do phone calls, Zoom calls, however they want to do it.
Yeah, communication is difficult. How do you think things may have been different if you would have met in person with the customer?
Well, I have met in person with these guys because they're local in Charlotte. But he never asked me to come in, and he already had the CAD file. So, you know, if he had sent me the picture – everything at the beginning, like here's an existing tool, we want to make something similar to this, I would totally get it. It's just weird to me that the guy never sent me that photo in the first place. Like, why would you assume that I would know what you meant when I had never made one of these for you before?
Now that you know this, what advice would you give to your future self or your current self as to how to handle customer requests, how to do proper communication to get the correct requirements so you deliver what they actually want?
Yeah, I mean, usually I ask more, but I was so confident I thought I knew what he wanted because it seemed super obvious. So it's just one of those situations where I guess Yeah, I don't think from this one I would really know. Most of the time, it's not that clear, or it didn't appear to be that clear to me. Where, you know, I guess I have a standard like list of questions for new inventors. This was a little different because this was like an existing product they just wanted to create this like tool for. So it's kind of different than like a brand new invention from nothing. But I do have a standard list of questions. It's basically, see if I have memorized. It's like, okay, first of all, what is this thing? Like, what is the point of it, right? What is the purpose that it's solving? Okay. Because a lot of times people will just send me a picture or some sketch they made, and I have no idea what it's for. They just assume that I would interpret their scribbling for, you know, whatever it is. So that's the first question I ask. Then I ask for the sketch because I need something visual. Then I ask for some sense of size. You know, is it, because a lot of times they don't put dimensions on it. So I'm like, okay, is this 6 inches long or 60 meters? I don't know. And then I ask for like materials, you know, if there's a certain material. And then like any like important features, right? So I just looking on my desk here as I'm talking to you, and I see like a Yeti cup. So if I was going to hire someone to design that, I would probably give a reference photo, because almost every product that people come up with, there's something similar. So find the similar thing and say, I mean, I think that's the best way to invent something. Honestly, you can communicate it to a designer. It's like, hey, here's an existing thing, but I think it'd be improved this way. Or the thing I want to create is brand new, but it looks like this. So at least I have a starting place.
I got an idea.
Or you can draw it, you know.
I got an idea. You probably already have done this, but what if you put that in your template whenever an inventor contacts you, exactly what you just told me now?
Oh, that's part of it. I said a sketch or photo of something similar, you know, and then mark up what is different about like your product. I mean, that's all in the template.
And do you
the questions I ask people?
You also ask them for dimensions.
Yeah, I don't. You know, it's funny. One guy actually gave me too many dimensions. He invented this pipe thing. He was what was his job? He was laying. I never heard of this type of job, but there's guys that lay. They call it laying conduit. So basically, when like a new building is being put in, especially like a skyscraper, tall building, they have like metal pipes and they push the wires for the whole electrical for the building through these pipes. And so he had an invention that had something to do with that. And he gave so many dimensions down to like such a ridiculous decimal point. I was like, nothing can be manufactured to this precision. And even if it could, it would cost you so much money. You don't need this. So I had to explain to him a little bit. Like, he went too far, but most people don't give me enough. Like, they just give me a picture of something, but they don't tell me any sizes. So, you know, if they drew it to scale, really, I just need one dimension and then I can scale the image and get the rest of them. But usually I ask for at least the overall, like if I had a cup, like what's the diameter, what's the overall height? And then everything from there, I can kind of figure out wall thicknesses based on like industry standard, other products, you know, the thickness of the lid and how tight it fits. I can figure out from other products, because that really wouldn't change, you know?
So my question would be, given that you had so many of these conversations, how many, just the number, this is the prep to my question. How many of these conversations with a founder that has an idea to develop a product have you had in your lifetime? Okay. So you're someone that knows this conversation very well. You know what people are going to come with, their concerns. What do you do with the person that's overly concerned about you stealing their idea? What do you say?
Yeah, I mean, I get a lot of those. I mean, I send the NDA immediately. Like, as soon as somebody contacts me, I say, here's the NDA. Because I'm not in the business of taking your thing. Like, that would be the worst thing ever for my reputation. I have zero desire to steal your invention. I've got plenty of my own. I've got a list in my, you know, that I've written down that I'll never finish, you know, creating these things. So, like, people don't worry about that. But I send them the NDA anyways. So, like, right off the bat. And some people don't want to do that. They want to do their own. That's fine. I'll sign their NDA. And, you know, I've never had a problem really at all with people saying that I took their idea.
Understood. Well, I think this is a good time to take a break to tell our listener that Being an Engineer podcast is brought to you by Pipeline Design and Engineering. Pipeline partners with medical device and other device engineering teams who need turnkey equipment such as cycle test machines, custom test fixtures, automation equipment, assembly jigs, inspection stations, and more. You can find us on the web at teampipeline.us. And this is for all of our valued listeners. we need your help getting to 100 podcast reviews. So you'll have a chance to win a $50 Amazon gift card if you leave us a review on Apple Podcast. Simply email the screenshot of your 5-star review and the little blurb to podcast@teampipeline.us, and the email will be in the show notes. We will announce the 5 lucky winners at the end of the first quarter in 2022. So we're here with Scott Tarsi of CADDesignHelp.com. So what are some, whenever you had these conversations, the 1,000 conversations that you, over 1,000, like you said, with the inventors, let's say, what, is there like a booklet? It sounds like it would be the same conversation repeatedly. It's like we have to train the inventor about the basic things they need to understand before they can communicate with us. Do you manually do that every time, or do you give them maybe a PDF to read or a video to watch before you continue?
Well, I have the template of questions, right? So I really try to get them to answer that first, and then, I mean, I will call them right away, but basically I need all that in writing anyways, so it's all documented. I can't remember every detail, like when I talk to somebody on the phone. So I just say, like, these 5 questions, like, we need to have that all written down as a starting point. You know, I would say 5-10% of people are really well organized and have like a very good design brief. I call it a design brief. It's basically the same thing as what I said, like, what, you know, what are these 5 standard questions? They answer that in their design brief, and they answer it very well, to where they have all the details. It's like, it makes my job super easy, like, because I know exactly what they want to make. But like I said, that's probably 10% of people got it. And those are usually the seasoned inventors, the people that have done it before. They got a new idea. They need a designer to make it. Those are my favorite people to work for, because, you know, they totally get the process. They understand what can and can't be done. They understand like how things are made. So they understand how to communicate. Those are the preferred people to get. But I get there's a lot of new people, and then I help them along and tell them, you know, what to do. I give them, I actually have some old design briefs that I'll send to them. I say, like, here's a perfect way to communicate this to me. If you can make something like this, and it doesn't have to be as pretty as what some of these other guys have done, but they did it in Photoshop, but like something visual is huge to communicate what you want to the person making it.
Yeah. Picture's worth 1,000 words. I get it.
Absolutely.
Well, obviously you've had success given who you are. You've had your sweet spot of freelancers that you delegate to. So obviously that's building on prior success and referrals, but for the times, like any other business, and maybe early in the beginning more than now, when you've had, because if you have to read somebody's mind and you design something for them, this satisfaction is, it seems like it's something that's, it could very well happen. So when there's dissatisfaction involved, when you design something that the person actually didn't want, or they communicate, there was a miscommunication and we turned something into them, how do you deal with the customer dissatisfaction?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's 1-2% of people every year. It's inevitable. If you work it long enough, it's impossible to make everyone happy. And personally, I feel like these are the people that are just not reasonable people to work with. And I try to just filter them out. Like, I've turned down jobs when I could just tell from the way that they communicated, they're really impolite. I just was like, this is not going to be worth it at the end of the day, and I'll turn it down. But I'm not perfect at that. And, you know, I'm willing to go back and fix things, but, you know, I can't go be like refunding everybody every time they want it, because I mean, I'm not only have I done spending much time doing their work, I've given up opportunities for other jobs while I was doing their job. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just going to happen sometimes, but most people are not like that. It's just, you're just going to always run into 1 or 2, like for me personally, it's like 1 or 2 a year. I do jobs for like probably 200 people a year on average. And it's always like 1 or 2 are like that. And they're just, my opinion is that they're just unreasonable. Like, they're just not willing to work with you at all. They're way too particular about it without giving you clear communication of what they wanted anyways. Like, there's basically nobody can make this person happy. You know, there was a job I just did where I personally thought the last engineer did a good job. I looked at what they gave him. I'm assuming they gave him the same information they gave me. I thought he did it more or less correctly. They said it wasn't right. And I thought, well, I could see how it could be different than what he made, so I'll take it on because I think I can do it. And it was like the same thing with me. Like, no matter what I did for these people, they weren't happy. Like, I changed it 10 times over, and they just, I don't know. They could not communicate it in a way that I think anybody would understand. So, you know, it didn't end well there, but that's not the norm. That's not the norm. Most people, you know, a few revisions back and forth, we conclude on the same, you know, product at the end, and they're happy, and you know, everybody moves forward. They go to production, and I go on to the next thing. You know, but I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I'm going to tell you how it is, and how it is anybody in this industry or any industry, you're going to run into people that you just cannot make happy. I don't care if it's running a hotel, a restaurant, or a design business. It's going to happen.
I understand. Yeah, but for the other 99 or 98% of your customers are walking away happy, and that's what matters. I understand.
Right, yeah. No one's going to have a perfect five-star review unless you're somehow finagling the system to avoid those people. 4.9 or 4.8 is good as anybody can do.
Exactly. Let's talk about 200 jobs, you said. What would you say is like the average length of a job?
In terms of like from when I get it to when it's completed?
Maybe, yeah, I need to be more specific on that. Like, how many billable engineer hours is the average job?
I do a lot of small things. I guess mostly because at the end of the day, an individual inventor just cannot afford a job that's going to be like 50 hours of work, right? So I would say that most things I do are somewhere in the 10-hour range. It's pretty standard.
10 hours. And what's the most frequent service that people come to you for?
Because
you do a whole bunch of things. That's on your website.
Yeah, it's. Let me look at my list this year just to kind of see what I've done recently.
A founder that knows his stats. This is a statistically driven answer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've documented every single job I've done and thing I've sold since 2015. So it's all written down.
Where do you write it down? I'm just curious.
I put it all in Excel. I thought about doing a CRM or something, but it's just like, it's going to barely save me time over just the system that I have. I mean, I spend 5-10 minutes a day, you know, with my customer, my Excel CRM, if you will. I did get QuickBooks this year because the taxes side got too complicated to keep doing that manually, but I used to do that manually too. But now the customer side, I mean, I'm doing, you know, let's see here. In November, I did 16 jobs. It's not that hard to keep track of 16. So for example, in November, I did this product for like a bathroom. Obviously NDAs, I can't say too much, but I did the bathroom product and 3D printed it. I did a wine decanter handle, 3D printed that. I did a job just doing the 3D of an electric rotor. Then I did a scaled down electric engine in 3D and 3D printed that. I did a job, and sometimes just CADs, like this exercise equipment for a dog, like a dog running on a treadmill. I just did CAD of that. I do like architectural type of work. Nothing that has to be stamped, but like anything, I can do any kind of floor plan, anything that doesn't have to be like officially stamped, because I don't have like a PE license, so I got to be a little careful there. But as long as it's something they can submit, doesn't have to have a PE stamp, I can do that. So I did this coffee shop layout.
Tell us about that. What do you mean? What kind of jobs need a PE license?
Yeah, like if you're going to go to like the city and you need stamped plans, then it needs a PE license. So you could do it, but you would have to have a PE stamp it. And it's too complicated for me to figure that out. Plus, I'm doing work for people all over the country, and you need to have a license in that state. But the woman who had this coffee shop, she just literally needed an AutoCAD drawing of it to show like the health department or something. Like, they didn't need a stamp. So it really depends on the situation. So I can do those kind of jobs. I just can't do ones that says this was approved by a structural engineer and everything. You know, I don't do those kind of jobs.
So would you say most people come to you to actually do the design in CAD? And is that correct?
Well, yeah. And get it and get a prototype.
And
well, it depends. It's like 50% of the time it's the prototype as well.
Got it. Let's see. When you quote, this is one of the most difficult things, I would assume, that quoting jobs, do you bill as you go, or do you quote in anticipation, like full-time upfront fee? How do you do it?
Yeah, I've gone back and forth on the best way to handle this. If it's going to be a lot of recurring work, I'll just, you know, bill it by the hour. It's just easier. If it's just a single invention, and it's pretty well defined, I'm just going to give it a fixed price because I don't think it's necessary to bill it by the hour that in that sense. But I do make it clear in my quotes that I do one revision, like one major revision, I guess we'd say, like a little small tweak here and there. I don't even count. But if it's like we go and make the thing or I make it and then you give me some update that's totally different than the original drawing, like that's kind of where I say, okay, we're going to have to like the scope has changed. It's been too big of a change. And most people we can come to an agreement on. That's what I'm saying. Because at the end of the day, the nature of this is that there's some back and forth and we can only do so much of that before it's taking too much of my time based on the original quote. So I guess that's the best way to answer that question for you.
So I wonder if, by the way, billing, it's a very interesting topic of any business owners listening, because I've spoken with other business owners who run engineering companies, and the response that you just had, that you go back and forth, and that deep breath that you took in the beginning is almost exactly what I heard from other business owners when asking the same question. It's a struggle knowing how to quote jobs, and that's why I ask different people how they do it. So if you said the average job is 10 hours. So when they come to you, say, okay, it's going to be 7 hours for the design. We're just throwing numbers here, arbitrary. And then 3 hours for the major design review and 10 hours total, something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you factor in communication? Because you got the emails, you got to craft.
Yeah, but that's usually not more than an hour or two max.
Okay.
Usually the first call is like 15, 20 minutes. Maybe have to do that a couple more times.
And when you bill, like anyone wanting to freelance, like do you send someone an invoice or how do you do that?
Yeah, I usually take the payment up front because I've learned early on if they don't have any skin in the game, then they're not really serious about it. And if they're worried about me taking the money, not doing the work, they can go read all the reviews I have and be sure that's not going to happen. I don't do any work typically without some type of deposit. And a lot of times, if it's just a small job, I just say, listen, if this is a $300 job, I'm not splitting this up. It's too much processing time to do it. You just got to trust me on it. And if they're not willing to do that, then I don't take the job.
Basically. I can just hear the confidence in your voice. You've been through this road. You know what's ahead. This is the way it's going to go. Understood.
Yeah, I don't budge on that at all.
All right. Well, is there anything that I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, is your audience people that want to start like a service business or a product business?
I couldn't tell you. I do know the statistics, like what countries listen to the podcast and from the reviews. I do get messages on LinkedIn that seem to be CAD designers. I haven't gotten a message from an inventor, but by all means, there may be an inventor listening out there to the Being an Engineer podcast. So the answer may be yes, but I don't know.
Yeah, I guess from the inventor side, because I actually do. One thing just came to mind that you may not know. I actually run an inventors group. I was just on the board and went to the meetings. It's called the excuse me, I got a bit of a cold. The INOTC, I think it's .com, but it stands for Inventors Network of the Carolinas. So we run it out of Charlotte, but it's basically for anybody that can make it to Charlotte. We've had people drive from 2 or 3 hours away. We've been running our meetings online because of COVID, but we're going to try to go back to in-person because I feel like there's a lot of value to talking in-person to people. There's a lot more value. But been running that organization. So I've met with a lot of inventors, done a lot of work for the inventors that go to those meetings. And when it comes to inventing, I think it's just, you need to create, and I've read books about this, like, or any product development, it doesn't even have to be physical products. You got to make your MVP, minimum viable product, and you just start testing it. Don't get wrapped up in making it perfect. Because then you'll never see if anybody even wants it to begin with. Like, you need to get it in front of people enough to even a sales sheet sometimes if it's too expensive to make a prototype. But you really need to just get like the first revision out there and then pivot from there. Otherwise, you'll just spend a lot of time and money up front. And then ultimately, maybe nobody wants it or there's not enough market for it. It's like a lot of people say, it's the saying fail fast, right? So get it out there. You're probably going to fail or there's going to be some issue with it. Just do it quickly so that you can keep moving on, iterating, and get to your final, sellable product.
Well said, Scott. Well, how can people find you?
Yeah, you go to my website, caddesignhelp.com. My email is info@caddesignhelp.com. I have social media channels all at CAD Design Help. I haven't updated it as much as I'd like, but I'm going to try to do that a little more often. And, you know, my podcast, 110 episodes or so far, approximately. I can't remember off the top of my head. The Engineering Entrepreneur. Check it out.
All right, Scott. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Yeah, enjoyed it.
I'm Aaron Moncur, founder of Pipeline Design and Engineering. If you liked what you heard today, please share the episode. To learn how your team can leverage our team's expertise developing turnkey equipment, custom fixtures, and automated machines, and with product design, visit us at teampipeline.us. Thanks for listening.